It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, and
Hi, Karen. You're
listening to It's All About Food, and we're here with Kathy Stevens. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there, everybody.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm way out in the middle of nowhere, but I'm so happy to be joining you.
I'm really looking forward to hearing about what you're doing today and what you're doing all the time. But let's just fill the people in today. I'm talking with Kathy Stevens. She's the founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. And basically, she spent her childhood on a Virginia horse farm, and in many ways it was an idyllic youth, one that instilled in her a deep love of and respect for all animals. She left the South for graduate school in Boston, Massachusetts, where she spent 11 years as a high school English teacher. And in 2000, she was asked to head a charter school in Boston, but instead, 1 year later, she opened Catskill Animal Sanctuary, one of the country's leading havens for farm animals and a center for raising public awareness of their sentience and their suffering, of their sentience. That's important, their feeling. Kathy lives behind the barn with her dog, Hannah, and the Canimal Act. Catskill Animal Sanctuary's director of Canine Pursuits and her cats, Fatboy and Mouse. She's an avid reader, loves to hike, swim, and bike, and spends rare quiet time with her partner, David, and her close friends. Okay, so you know a little bit now about Kathy, but we're going to hear a lot more and all the wonderful work that she's been doing. But before we get to that, I just want to say you're listening to It's All About Food. And you can call in with questions at 1-888-874-4888. Or anytime during the week, you can send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And many times on this show, I talk to a lot of people who have great cookbooks and are really passionate and obsessed with food like I am, and all the wonderful, delicious, healthy meals that we can make with plants. And other times we talk about the environment and how animal farming, factory farming specifically, has such a devastating impact on the environment. And I think both of these are really important issues. I don't talk very often about the animals, and I want to do that. We're going to do it today, and it's not that it's the least important subject. In fact, for me, it's the most important subject. I personally became a vegetarian because I didn't believe in pain and suffering, or I didn't want to support pain and suffering. Okay, so with that little introduction, here we are.
That was a good one.
Yes, so you've created this wonderful space in the Catskills.
Mm-hmm.
Where you've rescued and taken care of almost 2,000 animals in the 9 years that you've been in existence.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written a couple of books, and the new one is Animal Camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read it, and I really enjoyed it. And here's what I have to say. A lot of times, in order to get our message out, and for those of us who believe really in the importance of getting rid of factory farming and to encourage people to eat more plants, we bombard people with numbers. Numbers,
yep.
numbers. There's about 60 billion land animals across the globe that are killed annually for food. And that's just, we can't understand that number, 60 billion.
Right.
And so it's really important sometimes to hear individual stories about animals. And that's what's so wonderful about your book.
Thanks. You know, it was very intentional, the approach, because, you know, there have been so many books that have really profoundly influenced me and plenty of folks around the world. Dominion, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. I mean, lots and lots of books rife with statistics that tell the story of how animals are treated as commodities, you know, from the overcrowding to the manipulation of their bodies for greater production and all the confinement, statistic after statistic, how inefficient food production is.
Mm-hmm.
But there are no books that say this is
who they are.
You are doing this to.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we do tours every weekend, Karen, from April to October, and we've got plenty of literature available. We've got posters throughout the main barn and signage around the farm that explain all those numbers. But it's the animals. From my personal observation, it's the animals, not the statistics,
mm-hmm.
that make people say, oh,
mm-hmm.
I get it. I don't want to do this anymore. And so I felt like for all those, you know, the vast majority of people who don't have the opportunity to get to know pigs, for instance, in the way that we know our beloved pets, I wanted to show those people who the animals are and come at this important issue from that angle.
The word who is so important. And oftentimes when we speak about animals, we use it instead of he or she.
That's right.
Implying a thing or something without feeling or emotions or thoughts. And it's... And there are, who are the who's in these precious beings? I think it's important too to relate. You've probably heard this, but so often people say, "Oh, you care about so much about the animals. What about the people?" And the thing is, they are so connected in so many ways. And
yeah.
All of us who don't support pain and suffering of animals don't support pain and suffering in people. It's the same. But often for diseases, they use a poster child or someone who's in a very pathetic situation with some sort of illness in order to reach the hearts and pocketbooks of people.
Yep.
We don't connect to numbers. We connect to individual stories.
That's absolutely the truth.
Hmm.
And that's a perfect analogy. And, you know, regarding that question or that statement that we all hear, why do you care so much about animals when there's so much human suffering? Most people can't get this right away until they've done a fair amount of reading.
Mm-hmm.
But most of your readers will certainly understand that there's such a connection between human suffering and what we're doing to the animals. There would be far less human suffering, certainly in terms of starvation and malnutrition and chronic disease, if the world were vegetarian. Or close to it. Yeah.
That's right. It just touches so many things. We wouldn't have the wars that we have today because so many of the wars are linked to poverty, starvation, the raping of countries' resources, and a lot of those resources go into the terribly inefficient growing of livestock for food.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know you don't like that word, livestock.
No, I don't. I mean, I think it's useful to talk about in these contexts, but
yeah.
Again, it's another way of objectifying them,
right?
Making them commodities.
So a lot of times I think it's important to let children know about where their food comes from, and people really don't like the idea of letting kids know the truth.
The truth.
Because
right.
The truth is horrible.
Right.
And
yeah,
yet somehow we have to get numb to it as we age.
Right.
And I'm thinking your book would be great for kids and teens. Because it's not the horrific side, although you do touch on it, but it's the part that they could really relate to.
Right.
So that's another reason I like this book, and because there's
there's only one other, you may be familiar with it, but Ruby Roth's That's Why I Don't Eat Animals, or That's Why We Don't Eat Animals. It's a little picture book for kids.
Oh, nice. I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah.
I mean, I always say my favorite book about pigs is a book called The Good, Good Pig.
I haven't read that.
Mm-hmm. You've read it?
No, I haven't, but you mentioned it in the book, and I thought, oh, yeah, I got to read that.
It's just this very simple story of a woman who's a writer who had a pet pig. And, you know, the pet pig, Christopher P. Hogwood, is always in trouble. And at the end, you can't be a reader of that book and not have fallen in love with that animal. And I hope the same is true of my book, Animal Camp. You know, the subtitle is Lessons in Love and Hope from Rescued Farm Animals. And even 9 years into this work, what is still remarkable to me is how resilient and how forgiving and how ready to start over freshly in a new environment these animals who've come from just trauma and devastation are. I mean, they're really quite remarkable teachers in that way. You know, forgive, forget, move on, start anew. Every day is precious. And, you know, I wish I had time. I wish my fingers could type as quickly as one's brain works, because I could have 10 books right now.
Mm-hmm.
So every day there's something that makes us laugh, or, you know, every day there's a precious and important teaching moment with when you've got 250 animals in a space at any given time, and so many are free range because we treat them all truly as individuals. You know, we have a mantra that says, let each one heal in his own way, at his own pace, on his own terms, and we take that very seriously. And a lot of these animals who come from confinement or are old and picked on or what have you need freedom. They need to be, and so we have this rotating cast of characters called the Underfoot family, who really go and come and go as they please, and to give them the liberty of choosing to create each moment of their day and to watch how they do it offers one profound lesson after another. You know, the friendships across species, the protection of, you know, how Rambo the sheep a sheep who kind of figures prominently in both my books, has taken on all of Catskill Animal Sanctuary as his flock to protect. Mm. The ram in nature protects his flock. That's his job. He's decided that all of us are his flock. And, you know, it never ends the way they teach and delight us.
There are things that go around the internet from time to time because people are really touched by them, where we see two different animals that are really close to each other. There's the story of the dog
and
the elephant.
Right.
You know, and there are many others like that, and so you see it at your farm.
Oh, all the time.
And what is it? Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, it's just, you talk about Rambo and this chicken and what's her name, Barbara?
Barbie.
What do we learn from that?
I think what we learn, should I tell a condensed version of the story?
Yes, please.
Okay, Barbie is a broiler, the type of chicken that's grown for meat, and they have very short life expectancies because how they've been altered by agribusiness. And so Barbie can't live with, she at the moment is our only broiler hen. She can't live with our other healthier hens. They would just pick on her. She's just too heavy and her mobility is limited. So she's a free-range chicken who has, like so many other animals around the barn, taken to Rambo. Now, the problem is Rambo has a girlfriend who's another sheep who really dotes on him and sort of gets her security, sense of security from him. And Barbie likes to fall asleep on Rambo's back, and Hannah's jealous, so there's a whole chapter about how that developed and how it plays itself out. What I think is, it's not what I think, what I know is true, and one day science will prove this, and then all of us will say, yeah, of course, you know, but I know this to be true, and plenty of other people know this to be true. There is a spirit in living things that transcends species.
Mm.
And we certainly know it, those of us who've had more than one companion animal know that we've been connected to those animals to varying degrees. And, you know, we love everyone, just like everyone loves every child that they have. But there's some companion animals that we bond with more deeply than
mm-hmm.
others. I've always thought that it's that essence that transcends species.
Yeah.
And in the barn, animals, you know, pigs see pigs first, but then pigs see other animals. And it's not surprising, and so does every other beast
mm-hmm.
have the ability to see beyond species. And I think animals do it a little bit better than we do, getting to the core of who someone is. I mean, in this rescue, we were out on this wild rescue way out in Wisconsin yesterday, and this woman who is a it's a very disturbed and complicated hoarding case. This woman couldn't believe that a horse she described as very frightened and wary of people was following me around all day, and
mm-hmm.
I wasn't surprised.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyway, that's a long answer to that comment that you were making.
Well, just like humans, animals of the same species, they don't all get along. Some of them do, and some of them don't.
They're more like us than different, and that's one way that they're alike. Chickens choose their friends, pigs choose their friends, cows choose their friends. I could tell you, if our group of 20 cows, I could tell you all the friendships. The three who like each other, the seven who are a group, yeah, you're right about that.
Okay, now my two least favorite words in the English language.
Hmm.
Anthropomorphism and instinct.
Uh-huh.
So I want to talk about instinct just for a minute. I think we have a real misunderstanding of things that we label as instinct. I think, personally, instinct, especially in other species, is intelligence that we don't understand.
I agree with that.
And so we just kind of brush it aside, like, oh, it's instinct. It's something that they're born with, and they do it somewhat robotically without
mm-hmm.
any consciousness of it. And
mm-hmm.
until we realize that it's real intelligence, you know, we won't really be able to move forward and evolve in our own species. Then there's this I can't even say it.
You just did. Way too many syllables, though.
Yes. Anthropomorphism. Do you want to talk about that? You have a whole chapter on it in your book.
Well, I mean, I totally agree, just to back up for a second about what you said about instinct. I
mm-hmm.
think it's a convenient label that maybe science came up with that makes sort of minimizing or diminishing animals' capabilities too easy. And the same with anthropomorphism. Look at what white Americans, what the white race,
mm-hmm.
how we've across history treated, I mean, particularly in this country, white Americans, enslaved
Well, we saw the Native Americans. We thought they were...
The Native Americans. Right, and we thought them lesser and inferior because they were different. We either thought they were, or it was convenient to pretend that we thought they were, because then it was easier for us to use them for our own ends.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Because animals don't speak our language, and it takes a degree of attention that that we aren't particularly good at to understand an animal. It's so easy. And because we have this outrageous sense of entitlement as human beings, outrageous,
yes,
says, because I'm, you know, the might makes right thing, the whole concept of dominion and whether or not, you know, the thing that Matthew Scully explores is the dominion, what's the interpretation of it? Is it that God intended us to be caretakers, or God intended for us to lord over the animals? Well, I think that term, anthropomorphism, is used by science to dismiss people whose comfort level with animals makes them a little uneasy. It's patently absurd to me to say that dogs don't... I'm going to go so far as to say I can't find an emotion that we tend to think is the sole purview of human beings that is not shared by animals.
Just for a moment, let's just define anthropomorphism for those who might not know that 5 or 6 syllable word.
Okay. It's just the attribution of human, of what... humans label human emotions to animals, so that if we say a dog felt sad, then a scientist is going to say you're being anthropomorphic. Dogs don't feel sad.
Right. But since we have emotions, we like to put those emotions
onto animals.
And the reason why I don't like this word, and the reason why you probably don't like this word, is because animals do have feelings. And as you're saying, they have all the same feelings that we do. We're not making it up.
No, we're not making it up. And when you're surrounded by animals every day of your life, as I am, it's pretty, it's in your face.
Yeah.
There is no disputing it.
So,
but then science comes along and puts animals behind bars or in artificial and sterile environments and pokes them and prods them and tests them in a completely foreign and frightening and alien set of circumstances to try to prove or disprove a theory. And, you know, then the animals suffer the consequence. I mean, I think anthropomorphism is kind of falling out of favor with, as the community of people who consider themselves animal people grows.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I want to think that we are evolving, that we are becoming better, although there's a lot of stuff out there that's pretty horrible.
Yesterday's elections didn't give me too much hope.
It seems like there's a group that is moving forward, if not everyone, but there is a group, and so you hope at some point that they will become the majority.
Right. Before it's too late.
Yeah. Okay. So much for anthropomorphism. One day that'll just be in an ancient dictionary.
I hope so.
Okay. What else did I want to talk about? So, I dog-eared some things in your book, and I'm going to flip through them to see if I remember. Okay. I liked the way you talked about how you decide
who to take care of in terms of always taking the definition of an emergency rescue. You talk about always taking the neediest first, the ones that have run out of options.
Mm-hmm.
You have this really wonderful chapter on Noah, the horse, and how there was one woman in particular who just thought he should be euthanized because he was in such a sad state of affairs. But he definitely had a tremendous will to live and tremendous support of you and others at the sanctuary, and sounds like he's thriving now.
He's really thriving, and it was just a wonderful thing to participate in his recovery. I think we do absolutely take the neediest first. That's how we make our decisions. Who has no other options? You've got all kinds of constraints. You've got financial limitations, physical space limitations, staffing limitations, but all things being equal, you say, who's the neediest? And that's who we take. And sometimes it's one horse and sometimes it's 300 chickens. You really never know. That's the nature of emergency rescue. That's how we wound up in Wisconsin yesterday. But Noah, I mean, one thing that one absolutely has to get good at is that question of when to euthanize. You have to get clear in your own mind and heart about what your policy is. You have to communicate it to your supporters, whether those are your community. Because people have wildly varying views about that. My belief is you've got to, again, it goes back to that essence in each of us. I am not anti-euthanasia. I believe you got to look and assess an animal's quality of life and the degree of the animal's suffering and summon the strength to say goodbye when that quality of life is gone. But with Noah, who arrived from a nightmare and was in some degree of pain and looked like a nightmare, it was hard to see him in the beginning. It was hard to see this horse take inch at a time steps because he was in such pain. But this animal fought so hard to get out of his wretched circumstance that we at least, and fought so hard to stay alive for as long as he did in his wretched circumstance, which the book talks about, that he certainly wasn't in any more pain than he had been for a long, long time. Now he was in a deeply bedded stall and getting wonderful nutritional support and a low dose of painkiller as we were assessing what he was going through. And it was just very clear early on that he wanted to live.
You know, it's hard enough with humans because we're all supposed to have a living will and a health proxy, and people are supposed to know what our intentions are if we're in some sort of compromise situation. And, a lot of people don't even have that. And so when the unfortunate thing comes up where someone is on life support systems and you're not sure whether to pull the plug or not, it's a difficult choice. And with animals, it's even harder because we don't have the words to communicate. But when you see an animal with such a will to live, and the story was so compelling in your book.
Thanks. It was a pretty, to help that animal walk to learn through a whole series of medical things and finally a set of x-rays that he wasn't going to be permanently crippled was the first step, and then to have this gifted farrier who sort of reshaped his grossly deformed hooves, and then help this 20-year-old horse walk again. He couldn't walk.
Yeah, amazing.
And was one of the best experiences of my life.
People need to know more about that. We're going to take a quick break. Kathy, stay with us, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes. I want to talk about all the great things that are going on at your sanctuary. Okay, we'll be right back.
Okay, Karen.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
This is Mitchell J. Rabin to tell you that we have two new time slots every Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Join me as I interview and dialogue with the sung and unsung heroes of society with passion and with commitment. Scientists, healers, filmmakers, musicians, environmentalists, and gurus on Mondays, and a call-in show where you'll be the focus on Wednesdays. Again, Monday and Wednesday at 6 p.m., join Mitchell Rabin as together we create a better world.
Hi, this is Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. Every Thursday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, I will be coming to you live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I will bring my background as a physician and as an attorney to help you with a minimal pharmaceutical and a minimal surgical approach to your medical issues. Please come join me.
So to join in on the conversation, call 888-874-4888. Ask Dr. Eisenstein, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Tune in to City's Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world. Creative voices from various fields and backgrounds. New sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And with us today we have Kathy Stevens, the founder and director of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. And I invite you to visit the website casanctuary.org, Catskill Animal Sanctuary. Kathy.
Karen.
So tell me about the sanctuary. And can you take us on a virtual tour?
Oh my goodness. Well, I can try.
Just some of the highlights.
Well, what's okay. The first fun fact is that we were just getting on our feet, brand new sanctuary. Sort of recruiting our volunteers and getting all our legal stuff in order. When we bought our property, which was the only property we could afford, because, you know, 100 acres is in New York is $1 million or more.
Right.
So, in the Hudson Valley, at least. So we bought a junkyard. It had been a farm a couple decades earlier, but the owner had lost his son and had allowed it. Just kind of, I think his life, he could never recover from that, and allowed his friends to use this property illegally as a junkyard. So half the fun of, I'll take you on this virtual tour, but I needed to say at first that half of the fun of this has been rescuing this abandoned piece of property. I mean, oil tanks and 400 tires and a barn full of toilets and an open septic and 23 rusted vehicles and, you know, just, woo, it was work.
Yeah.
But now, you know, you drive down this backwards S-shaped driveway down a hill, and in front of you is a 6,000 square foot main barn. The barn has 20 stalls in it, a 16 foot aisle in the middle, and 10 stalls down each side. And it's sort of bisected in the middle by a hay room and a feed room. And that's where our special needs animals live. And that's where our underfoot family that I was talking about, and that animal, both Animal Camp and the first book talk a lot about, that's where they kind of hover. So when you walk in that main barn, depending on the time of day, you know, if it's before people have been turned out, you'll see blind horses and ancient horses or new horses who need the attention that comes with being right in the hub, along with other special needs animals, our little crippled goat Atlas, four elderly sheep who were being picked on by the flock, our two turkeys, Ethel and Blue, who really you have to kind of walk around in order not to trip over. And that's just sort of a very kind of joyful, central gathering place. The animal, we've got a free-range horse, but we've got free-range chickens running in and out all the time. We've got three free-range pigs named the Troubles. And that's where people, I think that's what people identify with when they think of Catskill Animal Sanctuary. They think of this huge, dark green barn where animals come and go and disarm people. Every single day with their antics and their the full expression of who they are. And then from that main barn, there are three roads spreading outwards in different directions. And kind of in the middle of all of that is about an acre pond surrounded by 33 willow trees. We're in a valley, so we're surrounded by gorgeous foliage, you know, north, south, east, west.
And it's probably spectacular right now, the best season of the year.
It's very pretty right now. You know, it's a property that has it. And then, you know, down these roads are 26 or 7 smaller outbuildings and barns, you know, everything from storage buildings to a big barn for the cows and a big barn for the pigs, et cetera. And it's a very, it's a busy but remarkably peaceful and joyous place. That's how I would describe it.
Very nice. Okay, so people can come to visit between April and October? Is that what it is?
Between April and October. We have members around the country, and sometimes it's tough for people to get there in the warm season. So if people are visiting out of some out of town during the holidays, we always invite them to give us a holler, and we'll try to accommodate them because they need to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're only around once a year, then we're going to take them on a tour.
Okay.
But officially, we're only open six
right.
months a year. It's just too tough in the cold weather.
And now you have a chef?
We did a national search for a vegan chef, and we got 31 applications and
wow.
found Kevin Archer. Well, he found us, but
mm-hmm.
he was cooking at a vegetarian cafe in Santa Fe after having owned his own restaurant briefly. He is, we interviewed three finalists, and they all came and sort of we really kind of put them through their paces because we wanted somebody who could, you know, the goal is to, I think, just to back up a little bit, that a lot of us would like to change our diets.
Mm-hmm.
But when we think about how to change this food that we've eaten our whole lives, that's part of our history, part of our traditions, that's what we know when we want to grab something quickly, to think about how to do it is overwhelming. So we wanted to provide the help. We want to do everything in our power to help people take that step, begin that journey. So Kevin cooked for a party. He did an informal lunch. We just put these finalists through their paces, and Kevin was such an obvious, clear choice.
Mm.
His food is versatile. He can do the fanciest dish you can imagine, or he can just do the best veggie burger one could conjure up. And it's accessible food. It's food that won't scare off
sure.
somebody who's just trying it for the first time.
Yeah.
He's also warm and engaging and hilarious and a wonderful teacher and very humble. He's just a dream. We're just really pleased with him, and we're doing some cool things with his Compassionate Cuisine program.
Well, the thing is, I am absolutely convinced that the best food on the planet, taste-wise, is vegan food. But just like any kind of cuisine, you can have bad versions and good versions of it.
That's right.
And it's so important in our proselytizing. I'm sorry. It's so important in our education to show people. I always think the best way to get the message across is through food and putting something delicious in someone's mouth. And when they know, oh, I'm not going to be deprived, I'm going to be satisfied, I can do this. And delicious food is such an important element in the whole picture.
Yeah, I agree. I think there are a lot of challenges. You know, we're short for time, and people think throwing a hunk of meat in the oven is quicker and simpler, and a lot of times it is, but there are plenty of shortcuts you can take with vegan cooking, and I completely agree. You quickly lose your taste for meat.
I think once you get the hang of it, really, it doesn't take any more time. It's just a question of planning and organization and having the right things on hand and knowing what to do with them.
I completely agree.
I mean, what is faster than eating an apple and a banana? You know, it doesn't have to be complicated, and that's
real food.
Yeah, and in today's world of manufacturing, even some of the simplest foods are already minimally prepared. What does that mean? Cleaned, washed, so you can get a bag of mesclun greens. My favorite version of potato chips, grab a bag of mesclun greens and just chomp on them. They're healthy.
Yeah.
It's easy.
I know. It's very true.
Yes. Now, How do people learn about your sanctuary and want to come to it?
Well, you know, we're on Facebook, we're on YouTube, we tweet, we've got a website, casanctuary.org. This new book has only been out for a few weeks, so that's all over the place. It's in bookstores and it's on Amazon, et cetera. So there are a whole lot of ways people can get involved. Can I just talk briefly about something that's going on right now? Okay. There's a growing, I don't know if it's growing or if I'm more aware of it, but I'm just going to point this out because this is a time of year when people who do give to nonprofits give. This is the giving season. We're going right into it. And we went to Wisconsin to help with a large rescue from an animal hoarder, and it is probably the 15th case we've had involving an animal hoarder. And I recently learned that one out of every six, I think it's one out of every six people can Google this. So it's either one out of every four or one out of every six. I think it's six. Animal rescues is actually run by an animal hoarder.
Oh.
This was a very alarming case. I can't tell you how many alarming cases we've seen, and I just wanted to put this very important piece of information in people's heads. I certainly encourage people, animals don't have voices. I certainly encourage people to support animal shelters and animal sanctuaries, and of course my bias is for the forgotten ones, the food animals, those who for the most part don't count other than as things to put in our stomachs. But please, I invite everyone to please do their homework. Make sure you're not putting money in the hands of people who are going to cause more suffering. Do your homework. Make sure the organization's legit. Make sure it's credible. Do a Google search. If you know, I can't name this place.
So there are places that advertise as rescue for animals, and they're just hoarding them.
Oh, they're a lot, Karen. They're a lot.
And why did they do this? Do you have any idea? I mean, it's an illness.
It's an illness. There are some pretty good articles out there. If you Google animal hoarding, I think it's PETA that has a pretty comprehensive article on the psychological makeup of an animal hoarder. You know, it's very clear. I was thinking the other day, it's like, what are the patterns here? You're not an animal rescue if you go chasing all over the county to auctions to buy animals. You're not an animal rescue if you have hundreds of animals and not a single volunteer. You're not an animal rescue if there are certain animals the public can see and another part of the farm that's closed off. This is when people write their checks, and I just would like to encourage people to make sure when you do that you're giving them to credible organizations, because it's a frightening problem with just devastating consequences.
We just came out of an election. Gulp.
We did.
I mean, it could have been worse, but it could have been a lot better.
Yeah.
And the point that I always want to make is that, okay, it would be great to have laws that support the things we believe in, but that's not where it starts. It starts with individuals. And if you're frustrated with the outcome of the election, or you're just frustrated with the way the world is in general, the best that you can do is be the best you can in your own life.
I'm so glad you said that. Yeah.
So I just remind myself, you know, I was watching the returns yesterday and thinking, who are these people with this short-term memory? They don't remember who got us in this economic mess to begin with, and now they're putting them back in office. The best we can do is clean up our own lives, clear out the violence in our own lives, and do the best that we can. And certainly supporting organizations that are doing good work and not supporting factory farming by eating healthy plant foods is really significant. And when you're thinking that no one else is doing it, what difference is it going to make? It's going to make a huge difference.
Well, 100 animals a year won't die for you.
Mm-hmm.
100 animals who feel pain in the same way that you do, who suffer in the same way that you would if you were locked in a crate and made to live in your own feces, who feel suffering in the same way that you do, who have the same desire, the same, you know, all, I had to sign a bunch of books the other day, and I've always signed my books, All Hearts Deserve to Sing, and I found myself suddenly, almost subconsciously, writing All Hearts Yearn to Sing.
Mm.
And I don't think people would dispute that.
Mm-hmm.
And so to live in a way that enables other hearts to sing, to do so, is a pretty powerful way to live. And it feels good.
And it feels good. That's right. You know, we're so frustrated, and we feel so powerless. But when you make this choice, it feels good.
Yeah, it really does.
Yeah, that's really a good point. And, you know, it feels good emotionally because you're really helping others, even though you may not know who they are. And I say that who intentionally, these animals, who they are, because they are thinking, loving, caring, sensitive, feeling beings. But we also feel good because plant foods are healthier. Let's not forget about it. And all this pain and suffering for humans with heart disease and diabetes and obesity and all this stuff because we're eating these animals and we shouldn't be. So all around you're going to feel good.
You're going to have so much more energy of all kinds. So much more energy.
You know, there are a couple of last things in your book that I wanted to talk about before we end because we only have a few minutes left.
Yes.
I forget the name of the horse that you had to put.
Oh, Max.
Max, to its end. To his end. Excuse me. And you talked about how you needed to know that you were making the right choice. And you looked at him to know if it was the right time. And you described that scene. It was really powerful. Where he looked over at the other animals, and he looked over at you, and then...
Well, he actually, he was standing in the aisle of the barn, and there were about a dozen of us surrounding him. And Max was a very wise, very old man, and he knew what was happening, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, when the vet said, "Are you ready?" Max turned his head as far as he could around to the left and slowly made eye contact with every single human being who had made a semicircle around him to say goodbye. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that he was saying, "It's okay, I'm ready.
I'm ready.
I love you. Thank you for this chance. It's been a good run."
Mm.
Yeah, I will never forget that. There have been a few like that. There have been a few like that, but that was a pretty powerful one.
Yeah. There are too many very, very special animals out there that are not given a chance.
so good, Lord.
And certainly, if I remember when I was really young and I decided I want to be a vegetarian, and my mom brought me to the family physician, and one of the things he said was, it's good to eat meat because you're giving more animals a chance to live.
Oh, God. That's in your bio, right? I remember reading that story. Lord.
I haven't thought about it in a while, but I'm thinking about it now because, okay, it's true. If we weren't eating animals, we would not be creating the 60 billion of them, and there would be a lot fewer. But the ones that were given a chance could really live, and they would be a lot happier.
Right. Would you have wanted to create a child so it could live through the Holocaust? Would it be better for that child and then died as part of that Holocaust? Because that's the lives of these. That's very much the lives that these animals lead. Why create them?
Anyway. So
anyway.
This is food for thought, pun intentional.
Yes. As we enter the holiday season.
Yeah, Thanksgiving is coming along. Do you do anything special for Thanksgiving at the sanctuary?
You know, for the last few years we've had a cooking class/contest where we, you know, people stuff anything they want other than
a bird,
and we've come up with these people that's just like five or six just amazing stuffed pumpkin recipes.
Mm-hmm.
This year, because this huge rescue came out of the sky, we're not doing anything special except sitting around as a group of people who love each other having a wonderful potluck.
Okay, well,
we
have a minute left, and I just want to remind people that the turkeys that are grown in factory farms are totally bred so that they're top-heavy. They can't stand on their feet. They're nothing like wild turkeys, and we don't want to support that. Even though you may think they taste good, they are really loving, sensitive, caring beings, and really don't. What are we thankful for? Are we thankful that we're able to torture other beings? I don't think that's what it's about. So, something to think about as this holiday is coming up. Kathy, you're just amazing. Thank you.
Karen, so are you. Thank you for being on the planet.
Thank you for being on the planet, and I am going to get to visit Catskill Animal Sanctuary, hopefully very soon.
Please.
Yeah. Okay, everybody get the book, Animal Camp. I think it would make a great gift for the holidays. And think about that. Go to casanctuary.org. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Next week we're going to be talking about another great subject, global warming, with Noam Moore. Join me and have a delicious week. Bye-bye.